Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Imagine a map of the world. Now zoom in on the Horn of Africa. In between Ethiopia and Somalia lies the country of Djibouti. This small country has become the center of Rachel Pye Jones's world, one that looks nothing like her Minnesota roots. Mireille Enos, you may recognize her from shows like Big Love, The Catch, and The Killing, reads us Rachel Pye Jones's essay, A Child of Two Worlds.
A Somali proverb says that a woman should be either married or in her grave. And in the Horn of Africa, the proverb might as well go on to say that if she is married, she had better be pregnant, nursing, or postmenopausal. My husband Tom and I moved to Somaliland 9 years ago with our 2-year-old twins to work for a non-governmental organization that aimed to serve the local population. But within a year, the escalating violence there forced us to evacuate, as in grab what we could and run, and resettle across the border in Djibouti. A couple of years later, when our twins, Magdalene and Henry, were 5, our Djiboutian Somali neighbors began suggesting that my next pregnancy was long overdue. Surely my marriage couldn't survive with only 2 children. And Asha, my landlady, added to the pressure, asking over chipped mugs of steaming tea, "How are the kids? Are you pregnant?" The trouble wasn't that I didn't want to have another baby, though part of me did fear the possibility of having twins again. The trouble was that I lived in Djibouti with neighbors like Yemen, Somalia, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. Pirates in the Red Sea, border skirmishes in Eritrea, intermittent political tensions in Ethiopia, and Al-Qaeda terrorists hanging out in Yemen. The trouble was that the nearest Western hospital was a 4-hour flight away in Dubai. The trouble was that I was terrified to be pregnant and give birth in Djibouti. Temperatures sometimes soared over 120 degrees. I heard stories of women being shouted at, pinched, and slapped by hospital staff and female relatives during labor. I knew of the severe lack of midwifery skills outside of the realm of female genital cutting. It was hard to find an opportune time when my heart, mind, and body were ready to conceive. And then, walking to school one day, Henry and Magdalene quit holding my hands. It happened simultaneously, as though they had planned it. I watched them skip into kindergarten and felt the emptiness of my fingers. I wiped a tear from my eye and decided it was time to face my fears. 6 weeks later, I was pregnant. At Dar al-Hanan, the maternity hospital, women delivered flat on their backs, with midwives pressing down on their uteruses. Nurses pinched and insulted the laboring women if they made too much noise. No one was allowed to be in the delivery room other than the midwife. "You got yourself into this," they would shout. "Didn't you know it would hurt? Stop being weak." Sometimes women gave birth in the hallways, depending on how many beds were available. I decided to do my prenatal appointments and delivery at the French military hospital, Boufar. The anesthesiologist did little to reassure me.
"Sign this," he said in French, sliding a piece of paper across the desk. "It says you have considered the risks of giving birth in Djibouti, that we can't medevac you out, and that you understand there are no proper neonatal pediatricians and no neonatal care in the country." I gulped and skimmed the paper, which also explained that, should I need a cesarean, he would perform it. "I recommend you go to France," he said, "or Dubai." I shook my head. "My husband is an English professor, and the university will already be in session. I can't do it alone." He sighed and stamped the release form. Asha kissed my cheeks when I told her I was pregnant and taught me a new proverb. "The mouth of my grave is open." "You should say this to people and ask them to pray for you," she said in Somali. "You or the baby could die at any time. But it wouldn't be that bad if the baby died. You could always have another one. You don't really love it yet anyway. It's not born. So it's okay if the baby dies." "I don't want to talk about the baby dying," I said. "You should say the proverb anyway," she said. "You are at a highly dangerous time of life." In Djibouti, pregnancy was highly dangerous for both mother and baby. The infant mortality rate was among the highest in the world, more than 15%. The maternal mortality rate, while much lower, was still cause for alarm. At the hospital, an Arab midwife handed me a plastic cup and said in French, "You know what to do." The bathroom had no toilet paper. The toilet didn't flush. The sink offered only dripping water. No soap, no paper towels. I shook my hands, semi-dried them on my skirt, and walked back to the office with my plastic cup, urine sloshing with each step. "You've had a C-section," asked the midwife when she saw the scar. "Yes, for the second of my twins." "Only the second?" "Magdalene came naturally," I said, "but Henry flipped. He wouldn't come out." She asked me whether I wanted to attempt a vaginal delivery. "I can do it," she frowned. "You should go to Dubai." "It'll be fine," I said, with more conviction than I felt. "Your French is terrible," she said. "I know, but I speak Somali." From then on, Fardausa, the Somali midwife, handled my appointments. She was confident, cheerful, and competent. 5 months later, on the fourth anniversary of the attacks of September 11th, my water broke. The significance of the date hung over me as we headed to the hospital. "I hope no one else is in labor," I said to Tom. "If the only delivery room was occupied, I would deliver in the examining room, which was smaller and could only hold the midwife and myself." "No Tom, no extra nurse, and they would have to first clear out the broken blood pressure machine, the scale, and the shelf of dusty bandages." My labor progressed slowly, and Fardausa was nervous about the other women arriving. She decided to pump me full of Pitocin to induce labor. Within 20 minutes, I was screaming for an epidural. Fardausa refused. "You can start pushing." I didn't believe her until Tom looked and said, "I can see her head." 2 pushes later, Lucy, Dexon, Victoria, Jones entered the world. I immediately prepared to nurse my new dark-haired daughter. "What are you doing?" Fardausa asked. "Nursing," I said. "Don't you want to give her water first?" "No." "Don't you want to rest first?" "No." "You don't have any milk," I ignored her. Fardausa explained that I had torn and began sewing me up without any anesthetic. When I screamed, she insulted me for the first time. "You just gave birth. Don't be such a weakling." "I'd rather give birth again." While she stitched, Tom filled out the paperwork for Lucy's birth certificate and American passport. Fardausa looked up from torturing me. "Why Dexon?" "She was born here," I said. She needs a local name. It means gift from Allah, she said.
I know.
It also means that's enough, Tom said. And she is enough, I said, through clenched teeth. Fardalsa dumped my placenta and bloody towels in a garbage can, and Tom walked Lucy and me back to our room. The room had a broken telephone, a narrow bed, and a plastic chair. Lucy was sleeping, and I held her close. Tom looked around the room. Where's the other baby? He joked. I don't know what to do now, with only one baby, no twins. He sat on the edge of the bed and dealt out a game of solitaire. Except for when I woke her to nurse, Lucy slept through the first night, her face serene and flawless. I kissed her rosebud lips, smoothed her hair, sang lullabies. This was my Djiboutian-American daughter, a perfect combination of my two worlds. Born to American parents in a Muslim country on a day of infamy, she epitomized the people and places I had come to love. While East and West became increasingly polarized over terrorism and religion and politics, Lucy would always remind me of the personal and human nature behind the news stories. Fardalsa came to check on us during that first night. She stood in the doorway, silhouetted by the hall light. And we smiled at each other. We had done what women throughout the centuries have done and would continue to do, what no divisions or rhetoric or wars could ever stop. We had brought life and beauty and love into the world.
Mireille Enos, reading Rachel Pye Jones's piece, A Child of Two Worlds. Rachel says her Djiboutian birth experience didn't end when she left the hospital. More from her after the break.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Rachel Pye Jones spoke to us from her home in Djibouti, where she's lived for 14 years. Lucy is 11, and Rachel's twins Henry and Magdalene are now 16. This year, she and her husband opened one of the first international English curriculum schools in Djibouti, and the family has no plans to leave the African nation anytime soon.
Giving birth here really bonded me to my community. When my friends saw that I was willing to stay and do this big life experience here and with them and by embracing their cultural traditions, it really deepened our friendships and deepened my own understanding of the culture.
That bond with local friends only strengthened after this story was published.
They were really excited to see a beautiful story of a good story coming out of the region, which so often people just associate Somalis with war or terrorism, or even now there's a drought. But this was really a great story. So we had a lot of good feedback from people.
Rachel and her family have adjusted to living in a Muslim-majority country, a strong contrast from their Christian community in the American Midwest. Rachel says it's been very important to stay authentic and honest about their Christian faith, while at the same time broadening their spirituality with lessons from their Muslim neighbors.
In the first 40 days after a baby's born, a Somali tradition is that the mother and the baby stay in the house for those full 40 days. I did that here. It was fantastic because you're just You're not expected to work. You just bond with your baby and you heal and your friends come and take care of you. And my friends did that. And so in that context of those 40 days, I really learned about being supported by my Muslim community here. And then at the end of the 40 days, they throw a party, like a baby shower. And so at that party, I had asked my own mother, who was here, if she would pray for Lucy, and she's a Christian. And I had also asked our landlord, Asha, if she would pray for Lucy, and she's a Muslim. And to me, that was really an example of building relationships with people and being authentic about my own faith, and at the same time, being able and willing to receive the blessing of prayer from my Muslim community as well.
Much of Rachel's family still lives in her native Minnesota, and she says it's hard to be far away. But at the same time, the benefits of raising her kids abroad are enormous.
I know a couple times my daughter, Lucy in particular, has heard about terrorism and again equating that with Islam. And she said to me one time, "Mom, does that mean that people think my teachers are terrorists?" And so we had this great conversation, and she said, "Of course they're not terrorists." And so it's been a chance for our kids to see the normality, I guess, of people of all different kinds of religion and skin color and across economic classes. It's really been a great experience for our kids to be third culture kids.
Rachel Pye Jones, the writer of this week's essay, A Child of Two Worlds. Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, says Rachel's essay really struck a chord with many readers and with him.
I just loved how this essay was about giving in to risk, you know, in every way. She's just like, you know, we're here, we're going to do this the way people do it here. And she just pushes forward with that.
Rachel continues to write and is working on a narrative nonfiction book. You can read more of her work on her blog, djiboutijones.com. Opinions varied widely when it came to Rachel's decision to give birth in Africa. She and Dan Jones respond in a minute.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Welcome back. Modern Love editor Daniel Jones says whenever the column runs an essay about someone embracing risk, the condemnation inevitably comes pouring in.
It's one thing to take those risks with yourself, but to take those kinds of risks with your children, you can't do that. You got to think about others. Some people don't live that way, you know, and this is a kind of essay that only expresses love to me. It expresses love and embracing the messiness of life. She seems aware of what she's getting herself into and is not naive about those risks. She's already spent a lot of time there. And it's not for everybody, but it's definitely for her and her family. And I think it's wonderful how the essay celebrates that.
Rachel Pye Jones took that criticism in stride, but also said her detractors were being unrealistic.
Because millions of women give birth in Africa every day, or all the time. So that was funny, interesting feedback. And some people were a little bit struck that we had named our daughter a name that meant being a gift from Allah. And were curious as to how I felt about that and using Allah for God, which we don't have a problem with because it's the Arabic word that means God. So it was interesting to get that kind of feedback.
Well, we want to know if you've embraced risk, and if so, what's your story? Send us an email or a voice memo to modernlove@wbur.org. Thanks to our reader this week, Mireille Enos. She says she was very moved by Rachel's story.
I'm a mama myself. I have two babies, and every delivery experience is unique and surprising, and I'm always moved to hear other women's experiences. And I also thought it was very timely right now when there's a lot of issues about people's experiences all over the world, and empathy is something that we are greatly in need of right now. I thought it was timely to look into someone else's experience on the other side of the world.
Thanks again to Mireille Enos. You can see her now on season 2 of The Catch, which airs Thursday nights on ABC. Next week on the podcast, Harry Lennox of NBC's The Blacklist on one man's realization that there is a distinct difference between simply living and actually feeling alive.
Early in my adult life, I had decided I would do whatever I liked, whenever I liked, and sort it out as I went along. I got away with that for 20 years.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.